today, and it has to all to do with a bad wreck that took place on the freeway and me getting here late this afternoon. So maybe I can pick up some time here on the Bible study. We'll see what we can do. Okay, I think everybody's just about found their seats and ready to go. So I'll open with prayer and we'll get started with the Bible study. Dear God, our Heavenly Father, we come before you again on this, your Sabbath day. Thank you so much for your word of truth. Thank you for the calling that you have given to us. Please continue to help us to understand more of your word. Fill us with your word and your spirit so that we can understand more and apply it in our daily lives. We ask for your guidance and direction upon this Bible study now, and your continued guidance with us the rest of the day. We ask all of this by the name and authority of Jesus Christ. Amen. Okay. We're going to be doing Numbers chapter 6 and 7 today, but as we usually do, let's do a review from the last time, which was covering chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Numbers. Chapter 4 had to do with the duties of the descendants of Levi. And if you recall, there are three branches of the descendants of Levi: the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites. In chapter 4, talks about the duties of the descendants of Levi. The duties of the Kohathites is regarding the tabernacle, when Israel would assemble the tabernacle together or take it down. The Kohathites had to do with the, took care of the most holy items, and they had to be careful in their packing of those items as well. A review of the duties of the Gershonites: they took care of the fabric materials of the tabernacle, what we call the tent fabric material. And the duties of the Merarites was the wood framing materials. Now, when we come to chapter 7, we're going to find out how these Levites are going to carry these materials as they move through the desert. Chapter 5, reviewing it real quickly, is that the camp must be kept from defilement. God's presence was in the middle of the camp, and no defilement could approach his presence. The law of restitution to a wronged neighbor was put forth, but with a new feature that the restitution goes to the priest if there was no relative. And also, the case of a wife suspected of adultery, the children of Israel would be going to the land of Canaan, where adultery was rampant. And so laws were set forth and admonitions to protect them. But there was also the case of the wife suspected of adultery. She was to be brought to the priest instead of the male judges. She was set before God to judge whether the act had taken place or not. And there was a ritual to determine the innocence or guilt. So that's just briefly a review from what we covered the last time. Now, we have observed that the Levites were set apart for service regarding the tabernacle. Service regarding the tabernacle. But what about if there was somebody who was not a Levite and they desired to commit themselves to God in some type of service? You're not a Levite, but you want to commit yourself to serve in some way. That brings us to the book of Numbers chapter 6, the law of the Nazarite. The law of the Nazarite. Verse number 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord." So what we're considering here now is a person who's not a Levite, they could separate themselves or consecrate themselves, commit themselves to serve God for a period of time by taking the Nazarite vow. Now, they could commit themselves perhaps in a way because of a special request. They need God to intervene in their life for something. Perhaps it's a health issue or something else that they need from God. They would take this vow in service to God for a certain amount of time. It could be to give thanks to God for the blessings that he had given them. Or it could be simply an act of devotion. But the Nazarite vow was to commit yourself for a certain period of time. The word Nazarite comes from the Hebrew word Nazar, which means to dedicate, or simply to dedicate oneself. Now, this is not a Nazarene. You've heard the term Nazarene. A Nazarene was a person from the city of Nazareth, from the town of Nazareth. That was a Nazarene. This is a Nazarite, one who takes a vow in committing themselves to God. From the New International Commentary of the Old Testament, it says this: the major difference between the priest and the Nazarite is that while only males could be priests, either males or females could become Nazarites. Furthermore, the Nazarite is clearly a layperson. So a layperson, not a Levite, but a man or a woman could commit themselves to God with this particular vow. Now, either a man or a woman could take the vow to live as Nazarites for a period of time. However, if a daughter, let's say a family had a teenage daughter that wanted to take this vow, the father had to approve it. He could either approve it and say, yes, you can take the vow, commit yourself for a period of time, or he could disapprove. Same thing with the wife. If the wife being under the man's authority, he could either approve her taking the vow or disapprove. And that's discussed more in Numbers chapter 30, verses 1 through 8. Now we see the phrase, a man or a woman. Sometimes the question comes up, was there really any women that did take a Nazarite vow? Well, there's none recorded in the scriptures. However, according to Jewish tradition says that there were some women in the Second Temple period later on in Israel's history that did take Nazarite vows. Okay. There are several regulations, better called prohibitions, concerning the Nazarite, and they're related to those concerning the priest or high priest. They're strict regulations when you take this vow. Here's the first one of these regulations. Verse number 3. He, or she, we could say, shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall neither drink vinegar made from wine, nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. Verse 4, all the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, from seed to skin. The Nazarite vow was something that was taken that put you out of the norm. And the norm in Palestine and in the ancient world was to eat grape products. Eat grapes, raisins, drink wine. That was the normal thing to do. So the opposite of the norm is to not partake of any of those. And that was part of the restriction of this vow. The first prohibition upon taking the Nazarite vow was to abstain from wine, strong drink, vinegar, and grape products. And we see this phrase, nothing by the grapevine. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. The Nazarites were asked for a higher level of consecration in this matter than the priests. The norm, not only in Canaan but elsewhere, was to drink wine and eat grapes. The Nazarites were marked out as special people, consecrated to God only. They were not to conform to the norms of everyday life. And thus, this was one of the restrictions. Now, the person taking the Nazarite vow usually determined the time period. You determined how long. And normally, it was 30 days, a month. Here's a comment from Hastings Bible Dictionary. Number 6 does not determine the length of these temporary vows. A rule had to be made, and it was decided that a person himself might fix the period, otherwise it should be 30 days. But sometimes a person took a vow for longer than 30 days. Here's from Unger's Bible Dictionary. The Mosaic Law speaks of such consecrations as being limited to a particular time that was probably fixed by the one making the vow. Yet instances occur of children being dedicated by their parents before birth to be Nazarites all their lives, such as Samson and Samuel. According to the Mishnah, The usual time was 30 days, but double vows were for 60 days and triple vows for 100 days. But the person taking the vow determined the time period. So grape products was one of the, abstaining from grape products was one of the restrictions. Here's another one. Verse number 5. All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. So, to take the Nazarite vow, a man had to let his hair grow long. If it was a woman, she left it unkempt, let it grow long. And, you know, most women like to take care of their hair, put it up, take care of it, comb it, etc. But the woman take the Nazarite vow, let it go. Let it go wild, you would say. Okay, so the second prohibition was not to cut or trim the hair until the vow is fulfilled. Hair, being a living, growing part of a human, was symbolic of life, and thus a person's dedication to God as a Nazarite. Symbolic of life and the person's dedication to God. Now, you might think, well, that seems strange in the scriptures to let one's hair grow long. And in the New Testament, it talks about not doing that. But this was the opposite of what the pagan priests did in the ancient world. The pagan priests, especially the Egyptians, shaved their heads completely bald. And they trimmed their beards and put the pagan symbols on it and did all kinds of things, cut themselves, etc. So growing the hair long was the opposite, again, of the norm of what the pagans did. Priests in the ancient pagan cults shaved their heads. Here's from a comment from the Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary. In contrast to Canaanite priestly practices, Levitical regulations prohibited Israelite priests from allowing their heads to be shaved or trimming the hedges of their beard as well as cutting themselves. So again, opposite of what the pagan priests did. Now, again, the question, what about a woman's hair? Here's a comment from Expositor's Commentary. Since women in most cultures wear their hair longer than men do, we may presume that Nazarite women might not only have to let their hair grow long, but may have to have allowed it to remain relatively unkempt, or perhaps hang loose, as opposed to putting it up. So that's the second regulation regarding hair, which is a symbol of life. Another regulation about approaching a dead body. Remember, we talked about in Leviticus that death is the opposite of life, and approaching a dead body caused one to be unclean, thus they could not come into the tabernacle courtyard area. Another regulation, verse 6. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. Verse 7. He shall not make himself unclean, even for his father or mother, for his brother or sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. Verse 8. All the days of his separation, he shall be holy to the Lord. So the third prohibition was not to approach a dead body, because contact with a dead body rendered one unclean. Comment about verse number 7 from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. The prohibition of casual contact with the dead, even a dead mother or father, effectively reduced or eliminated the Nazarite's participation in the mourning for the dead. This is important because of the pagan practice of shaving one's head in mourning for the dead. Remember, that's what the pagans did. We talked about that in Leviticus. They shaved their heads and they mourned for the dead. They cut themselves and they did all kinds of different things. So again, this is the opposite of what they did in those pagan times. Now, what about if somebody accidentally has somebody die next to them? There's 2 million people amongst the children of Israel. That's a lot of people. Somebody could have a heart attack next to you, or something could happen, and you've taken that vow, and somebody, you've been near somebody who's dead. So that's what verses 9 through 12 talks about. Accidental pollution from a dead corpse. And a dead body would cause a Nazirite to become unclean, even though contact was accidental. Verse number 9. And if anyone dies very suddenly beside him and defiles his consecrated head, the vow that he had taken, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. Now that's kind of difficult in our King James language, so I have verse 9 in the paraphrase. I think it explains it a little bit better. If he is defiled by having someone fall dead beside him, then 7 days later, he shall shave his defiled head. Then he will be cleansed from the contamination of being in the presence of death. So somebody accidentally dies next to you, 7 days later, you shave your head. Then, on the eighth day, you have to bring an offering. That's discussed in verse 10. Then on the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves, two young pigeons, which was an inexpensive offering, to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And the priest shall offer one as a sin offering, the other as a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned in regard to the corpse. Now that's a little bit difficult in our King James language, because he sinned. Actually, better terminology would be because he came into contact with the unclean person. Continuing on then, and he shall sanctify his head that same day by letting his hair regrow. Verse number 12, he shall consecrate to the Lord the days of his separation and bring a male lamb in the first year as a trespass offering. But the former days shall be lost because of his separation was defiled. So what verse 12 is saying is you got to start the vow all over again because of coming in contact with the dead body. So this was one of the other regulations. And basically the bringing the offerings goes back to what we talked about in Leviticus chapters 12 through 15 when somebody became unclean and what they had to do in bringing offerings because of their uncleanness. Verse 13 through 21 talks about when you want to come out of the vow. Your time is up. You want to voluntarily terminate your vow. The procedure for transition from the special consecration of a Nazirite back to an ordinary layperson is what's discussed in this next section. Verse 13. Now this is the law of the Nazirite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, let's say you had 30 days in this vow, 30 days are up. He shall be brought to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So he's brought to the tabernacle courtyard to the gate. Then he has to have with him four types of offerings. And these are costly offerings. Verse 14. He shall present his offering to the Lord. One male lamb in its first year without blemish as a burnt offering. So that's the first type of offering, the burnt offering. A young male lamb without blemish, costly. Secondly, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish as a sin offering, the second type. One ram without blemish as a peace offering, the third type. Verse 15, a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and their grain offering with their drink offerings. So the grain offering was the fourth type of offering. Four types of offerings had to be brought when you want to go back to being a regular person, let's say. Verse 16, then the priest shall bring them before the Lord, offer his sin offering and his burnt offering out on the altar in the courtyard. Verse 17, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of a peace offering to the Lord. With the basket of unleavened bread, the priest shall also offer its grain offering and its drink offering. Verse 18, then the Nazirite shall shave his head, consecrated head, at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So after these offerings are done on the altar, he shaves off his long hair. And shall take the hair from his consecrated head, put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. So the hair is burnt. along with the peace offering. The hair, the Nazirite, symbolic of life dedicated to God, is here given to God on the altar, and it's burnt. Verse 19, and the priest shall take the boiled shoulder of the ram, one unleavened cake from the basket, one unleavened wafer, put them upon the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved his consecrated hair. And the priest shall wave them as a wave offering before the Lord, for they are holy for the priest, together with the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering. After that, the Nazirite may drink wine. So you have to go through these four sacrifices, burn your hair on the altar fire, then you are able to go back to becoming a regular layperson. Verse 21, this is the law of the Nazirite, who vows to the Lord the offering of his separation, and besides that, whatever else his hand is able to provide, according to the vow which he takes, so he must do according to the law of his separation. Now the only person in the Old Testament actually called a Nazirite was Samson. You can find that in the book of Judges, chapter 13 and chapter 16. Although Samuel was apparently one also, but he wasn't called a Nazirite, but the description fits. Now, according to Amos, chapter 2, and Lamentations, chapter 4, it was something that was done quite often. It just wasn't recorded in Scripture. Now, the Nazirite took that consecrated vow to separate himself, commit himself to God. Today, we don't take these kind of vows. We are set apart by the Holy Spirit to be living sacrifices, to be a holy priesthood set apart to God, to serve God in the church. So we don't take those particular vows the way that they did in the ancient times. We're set apart to serve God as living sacrifices, especially with the Holy Spirit. That takes us to the end of the Nazirite vow. We have one section left in chapter 6, the Aaronic blessing, Aaron's blessing. And that's verses 22 through 27. Verse 22. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. This is the blessing that God taught the priests to pronounce to the children of Israel, how that they were to bless them. Similar to what Jesus Christ did, teaching the disciples how to pray in the book of Matthew. Now, most likely the words of this blessing was spoken by Aaron that climaxed the worship service at the conclusion of the dedication of the tabernacle. Remember this in Leviticus chapter 9 and verse 22. This was after the priests had performed their very first sacrifices as priests of Israel. This is what Aaron did. Verse 22. Then Aaron lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from the offering, from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offering. And most likely, these are the words that he spoke when he gave that particular blessing. And what happened afterwards was God's presence came down and consumed the sacrifices that were on the altar. God's presence then was with the children of Israel. So that's briefly the Aaronic blessing, and that brings us to the end of chapter 6. Now, what we're going to be doing now, as we approach chapter 7 of the book of Numbers, is we're going to be flashing back in history, a narrative flashback. This is what we read when we started the book of Numbers in Numbers chapter 1 and verse number 1. Notice this. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, and Notice that this was the second month of the second year. That continues on all the way to the end of chapter 6, where we just finished off with Aaron's blessing. Chapter 1, verse number 1, all the way through the end of chapter 6, was the second month of the second year. When we come to chapter 7 now, we're flashing back in history to what occurred back in Exodus when the tabernacle was finished, when it was completed. Exodus chapter 40 and verse 17. Notice this. It came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. It was finished. It was ready to go on the first day of the first month of the second year. That's the same as what we're going to read in Numbers chapter 7, verse number 1, the first month. Notice it says, verse number 1 of chapter 7, now it came to pass when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, that he anointed it, consecrated it, all its furnishings, its utensils, and anointed them and consecrated them. Now it doesn't mention here the first month, but obviously because it was when the tabernacle was set up, it was when the first month had taken place. So we're flashing back in history, back to when the tabernacle was finished, at the beginning of Numbers chapter 7. Now to bring the point home a little bit more, here's something that I gave you previously in the book of Numbers, that the book of Numbers, especially chapters 1 through 10, is not in chronological order. And to rearrange it in chronological order, in the second year after leaving Egypt, it would look like this. The first day of the first month was Numbers chapter 7, verse number 1. Also, Exodus 40, verse 1, 2, and 17, the first day the tabernacle was set up. Then, something that's not been talked about at all in Exodus or Leviticus, but it will be talked about in chapter 7, is for 12 days, the first through the 12th day of the first month, in chapter 7, for 12 days the tribes brought offerings for the tabernacle consecration. That's not been talked about at all in the book of Numbers. For 12 days, and each day, one leader from the tribe is going to bring a special offering. Then on the 14th day, again still of the first month, the Passover will be kept. And we find that in chapter 9. The very first Passover took place in Egypt. In Egypt, Exodus chapter 12, and because of the Passover, in the blood, the children of Israel were set free from their slavery. The next Passover is going to take place, what we're going to read eventually, in chapter 9. And that was on the 14th day of the first month. What we could say is the second Passover for the children of Israel, the second one that they partook of. But now I got the line through the middle of the drawing there. The first day of the second month is what we find in chapter 1, verse number 1, all the way through chapter 6. The first day of the second month, when the census was taken, and all the things that we read up to the end of chapter 6. Then on the 20th day of the second month is when the children of Israel are finally going to leave Mount Sinai and head towards the promised land. So that's just a reconstruction in chronological order. But chapter 7 takes us back to the day when the tabernacle was finished. That's where we're going to go now. Numbers chapter 7 is the second longest chapter of the Bible. Who can tell me real quick what's the longest chapter of the Bible? Psalm 119 is the longest chapter in the Bible. This is the second longest chapter of the Bible. And again, as I've already been talking about, this is a narrative flashback. Events with the completion of the tabernacle, the first day of the second year after leaving Egypt, and corresponds with Exodus chapter 40. Okay, so let's get into it. Verse number 1. Now it came to pass when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, that he anointed it, consecrated it, and all its furnishings, and the altar, and all its utensils. So he anointed them and consecrated them. Verse 1 repeats the account from Leviticus chapter 8, the consecration of the altar, adding what was not told in Leviticus of the tribal leaders bringing gifts for 12 days. Here's what we read back in Leviticus chapter 8, verses 10 and 11. On the first day when the tabernacle was raised up, Moses took the anointing oil, anointed the tabernacle and all that was in it, and consecrated them. Verse 11, he sprinkled some of it on the altar 7 times, anointed the altar and all its utensils, its laver and its base, to consecrate them. So what we read in Leviticus, where Moses anointed and consecrated the tabernacle, is what we're now reading here in Numbers chapter 7, on the first day of the second year after they came out of Egypt. And we see these verbs, anointed and consecrated, those present see that the tabernacle and its furnishings were set apart to be special in the worship of God. So Moses consecrated, anointed the tabernacle, its furnishings, so he anointed them. Verse number 2. Then, this hasn't been talked about yet, then the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' houses, who were the leaders of the tribes, over those who were numbered, made an offering. So, again, has not been talked about in Leviticus or Numbers so far. This is going to last for 12 days, each leader bringing gifts. Now, one of the reasons that this chapter is out of chronological order is the leaders are named here to mention the gifts brought in light of their responsibilities that were brought out in chapters 3 and 4. And these leaders are the same ones that are named in chapter 1, verses 5 through 16, the ones that helped Moses with the census. Now, for whatever it's worth, I just added this. I thought it was kind of interesting. But according to a Jewish rabbi, according to Rashi, this is from the Tanakh Jewish Study Bible, according to Rashi, the chieftains of Israel are the same officers who were in charge of the slaves in Egypt and beaten on the Israelites' account, where they are called foremen in Exodus 5 and verse 14. And here's that scripture, Exodus 5:14. Also the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not fulfilled your task in making both brick yesterday and today as before? So I thought that was kind of interesting for whatever that was worth. Possibly those leaders. Okay. Verse number 3. And they brought their offering, the leaders did, before the Lord, 6 covered carts, 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders, and each one an ox. And they presented them before the tabernacle. This explains now how they're going to carry those materials in the desert. You know, when they disassemble the woodwork and the tent materials and everything that they're going to be taking through the desert, they're going to be using these carts and oxen. That's why they're presented as gifts. Now, the offering here comes from the Hebrew word korban, which means to bring near, a type of approach offering. And the leaders are bring their offerings near to God's presence, their special gifts. And regarding the covered carts and the 12 oxen, expositor's commentary adds this. Covered wagons would certainly be appropriate for transporting the sacred items. I suspect the pairs of oxen were matched and stately, suitably chosen for their significant work. Another reason why this is out of chronological order is that the wagons that are presented as gifts in the oxen show that the camp is about ready to move, which would be happening soon, as we'll see very soon in the next Bible studies. Verse number 4. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, accept these, the gifts, from them, that they may be used in doing the work of the tabernacle of meeting. You shall give them to the Levites, to every man according to his service. So, they're going to be given to the Levites to move the tabernacle parts and the furniture as they would make their way through the desert. Verse 6, so Moses took the carts and the oxen, gave them to the Levites. So Moses distributed the six covered carts, the pairs of oxen to the Gershonite and the Merarite Levites, according to their responsibilities of carting and assembling the tabernacle. Verse 7, two carts and four oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. Verse 8, four carts and eight oxen he gave to the sons of Merari according to their service, under the authority of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. Verse 9, but to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because theirs was the service of the holy things, which they carried on their shoulders. So in verse number 7, the Gershonites, they were responsible for the fabric materials of the tent. They were given two carts and four oxen. In verse number 8, the Merarites, they were responsible for the wood framing materials of the tabernacle, which was obviously more heavy. They were given four carts and eight oxen. But the Kohathites, who had to carry the holy items, the Ark of the Covenant and the lampstand, etc., they had to carry them on their shoulders. They were not given any animals or carts. Verse number 10. Now the leaders offered the dedication offering for the altar when it was anointed. So the leaders offered their offering before the altar. Now I want to stop here for a moment, talking about the leaders offering their dedication offering when they brought their gifts. This word dedication comes from the Hebrew word Hanukkah. Now, I'm sure you've heard the word Hanukkah. That's what the Jews do around late November, December time, when they celebrate the rededication of the Second Temple in the late 167 A.D. Dedication offerings were often given, we find, in the Old Testament scriptures. For instance, they dedicated and they celebrated when Solomon's temple was dedicated. When Solomon finished the temple, when it was dedicated, they had a grand celebration. When the wall was built, Jerusalem wall was built, when the Jews returned back to Jerusalem in Nehemiah chapter 12, they also had a dedication celebration. And later on in 167 BC, when what we call the abomination of desolation took place, when a Greek leader came in and roasted a pig on the altar, the abomination of desolation, a bunch of Jews chased them out. Then they rededicated the tabernacle with all kinds of lights and lamps, and they still celebrate that today in what they call Hanukkah. But anyways, my point is, whenever a dedication was taking place, there was celebration involved. It is well celebration with this. Verse number 11. For the Lord said to Moses, they shall offer their offering, one liter for each day, for the dedication of the altar. So each day, one liter brought those gifts, and they celebrated all day long. The next day would come along, another leader from one of the tribes would bring his gift, and they celebrated. And that continued on for 12 days. Okay. So one liter for each day, Expositor's Commentary adds this. This shows the pacing that God required. Each liter's gift was worth a day's celebration. It was such an important event. The tabernacle was finished. God's presence was going to be in the tabernacle. And they celebrated each day these gifts were brought. And each leader from the 12 tribes will bring his offering, one each day for 12 days. And the order of the presentation of gifts was the same as the order of march as they went through the desert. Okay, that brings us now to a long section, verses 12 through 88. Here's a comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. This passage is one of the most repetitive and consequently one of the most ignored passages in the Old Testament. The cumulative effect of the repetition is that the readers are assured that each tribe had an identical share in the support of the ministry of the tabernacle. In other words, we see that each tribe gets involved in presenting gifts and celebrating the tabernacle being erected. Okay, now we come to the very first one, which is the leader from the tribe of Judah. Judah would gain prominence in Israel's history, and of course, David would come from the tribe of Judah, and eventually Jesus Christ as well. So they bring their offering first on the first day. Verse 12. The one who offered his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Amminadab, from the tribe of Judah. Verse 13. His offering was one silver platter. If you're reading in the King James Version, it is charger, silver charger, the weight of which was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mixed with oil as a grain offering. Verse 14, one gold pan, or gold spoon as it is in the King James, of 10 shekels, full of incense. So all these items were brought as offerings, the silver platter, the bowl, and the gold pan. Then in verse 15, they brought animals as gifts as well. Verse 15, one young bull, one ram, one male lamb in its first year as a burnt offering, one kid of the goats as a sin offering. Verse 17, and for the sacrifice of the peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs in their first year. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Amminadab. So verse 12 through 17 shows us that the first day, the leader of Judah brought a silver platter weighing 4 pounds, a 2-pound silver bowl, a golden pan weighing 6 ounces, and they were expensive gifts that were brought. Now let me add, most likely, these were spoils that they got from the children, from the Egyptians when they left Egypt. These silver items. Very expensive. Okay. This was the first day. Each tribe's gifts from the 12 tribes are identical. They brought the very same gifts each day. One silver platter, one gold pan, one kid of the goats for sin offering, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 goats, 5 male lambs for peace offerings. They all brought the same offerings, just a different day for 12 days. Now I have this broken down for you a little bit to understand a little bit more of what was involved here with the silver platter, the silver bowl, and the golden pan. The platter in the old King James was charger, comes from a Hebrew word which means a deep dish. This was probably used for the bread of the presence on the table of showbread in the tabernacle. And again, a gift that was offered for use in the tabernacle. The bowl comes from a Hebrew word, which means to toss. A receptacle used for tossing liquids. This was most likely used for the tossing of the sacrificial blood against the altar. And again, a gift to be used in the service of the tabernacle. And finally, the pan, or the spoon, comes from a Hebrew word which means a cupped surface, probably used for the incense used in the incense altar in the tabernacle worship. And each tribe brought the same gift on a different day. And of course, then they brought the animals for the sacrifices as well, as in following the instructions from the book of Leviticus. So, we've already read the first day's offering by the leader from Judah. Then, for virtually the rest of the chapter, it goes through the same gifts and lists the days from the various leaders. So I'm not going to repeat everything from each day because it's repetitive. I'll just mention who it is that brings their gift and on what day. Verse number 18, on the second day, Nethanel, the son of Zuar, leader of Issachar, presented an offering. And he brought the same offering that the leader of Judah did, all the way through verse 23. Verse 24, the third day, the leader of the children of Zebulun presented his offering. And again, each day then a celebration took place as these gifts were offered. Verse number 30. On the fourth day, the leader of the children of Reuben presented his offering, the silver platter, bowl, the pan, and the animals, etc. Verse 36. On the fifth day, the leader of the children of Simeon presented his offering. Verse 42. The sixth day, the leader of the children of Gad presented his offering. 48. The seventh day, the leader of the children of Ephraim presented his offering. And again, celebration took place each time one of these offerings were presented during that day. Verse 54. On the eighth day, the leader of the children of Manasseh presented his offering. Verse 60. On the ninth day, the leader of the children of Benjamin presented his offering. Verse 60. That was the eighth. Repeated. Okay, I repeated that. I didn't realize that I did that. Okay, we'll drop down to verse number 66. On the tenth day, the leader of the children of Dan presented his offering. Verse number 72, the 11th day, the leader of the children of Asher. And finally, on the 12th day, the leader of the children of Naphtali presented his offering. And this ends the section, the 12 days that the leaders all brought their offerings. And the 12 days are over now, and the celebrations that took place as well. We're winding down now. Verses 84 through 88 summarizes the 12 sets of gifts given in mathematical detail. In other words, the tally of all of these offerings together. Verse 84. This was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. 12 silver platters, 12 silver bowls, 12 gold pans. Verse 85. Each silver platter weighed 130 shekels, each bowl 70 shekels, and all the silver of the vessels weighed 2,400 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Verse 86, the 12 gold pans full of incense weighed 10 shekels apiece, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. And all the gold of the pans weighed 120 shekels. Verse 87, all the oxen for the burnt offerings were 12 young bulls, the rams 12, the male lambs in the first year 12, with their grain offering, and the kids of the goat as a sin offering 12. Verse 88, and all the oxen for the sacrifice of the peace offerings were 24 bulls, and the ram 60, the male goat 60, the lambs in their first year 60, and this was the dedication offering for the altar when it was anointed. And what we don't have described in these verses is the actual celebration that took place. And can you imagine realizing that God's presence was with them in the tabernacle on earth to guide them on their journey through the tabernacle? It was worth a grand celebration. Finally, we come to the last verse in chapter 7, a summary reminder in verse 89. Now when Moses went into the tabernacle of meeting to speak with him, to speak with God, he heard the voice of one speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the two cherubim. Thus he spoke to him. This was a reminder that the place God promised to speak to Moses on completion of the tabernacle is mentioned here in verse 89. That it's actually fulfilled the promise that God gave to Moses. Here was the promise. This is where we'll end up. Exodus 25, verse 22. God said to Moses, and there I will meet with you and speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I will give you in commandment to the children of Israel. And when the tabernacle was completed, Moses did hear God's voice. And can you imagine hearing God's voice? What a powerful thing that must have been for Moses to actually witness that. That brings us to the end of chapter 7, but I will leave you with some lessons like we usually do. First of all, the Aaronic blessing, Aaron's blessing, was a prayer for God to live among his people and meet all their needs. The lesson is, for all of us, God alone can bless his people by guarding them, giving them favor, in peace. And also what we just talked about, each leader of the tribes brought gifts, one leader for each day, and it was paced that way. Each leader's gifts was worth a day's celebration in God's presence. And I'd like to finish with this. Imagine the celebration that will take place when Jesus Christ returns to this earth the second time, sets up his throne in Jerusalem, begins to rule, and we finally have peace on this earth. Let me tell you, it will be a great celebration. God's presence on earth. And we can even look forward to the time when the new Jerusalem comes down to this earth, and God's presence will be here. What a time of celebration. It's a time to look forward to. That brings us to the end of the Bible study, unless anybody's got any questions or comments.